Welcome to NuclearCast, the official podcast of the Hanwha Deterrent Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Walker, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrent Studies. The Hanwha Deterrent Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NuclearCast. Of course, as always, I'm Adam Wilder, and today we have a great guest. I know I say that every time, but I have the benefit of being truthful when I say that. And so in keeping with our history of great guests, of course, I'm talking about Bruce Tarter, the Director Emeritus of Lawrence Livermore National Labs. He's our guest today. We've got a former lab director. I mean, we're a lucky group today to have Bruce with us. And of course, Bruce is a godfather, a don who was around at Livermore to see so many things that I wish I could have seen in my career, but he did it. He not only did he see it, but he did it. And of course, he wrote a great book about it, The American Lab, and Insider's History of Lawrence Livermore National Lab, which chronicles much of sort of the science and, you know, what the lab did. So it's in keeping with our discussions with Tom Ramos and our friends up at Oak Ridge National Lab and Y-12, and this discussion and look at the relevance and history of the labs. So welcome to NuclearCast. Thanks for coming, Bruce.
Glad to be here.
So let me sort of start you off with kind of one of those softball questions to get the ball rolling. Can you talk a little bit about how the technology that the lab developed, that Livermore developed, how did that influence policy and strategy and the way we thought and implemented our arsenal, deterrence writ large? How did the lab and what it did influence that?
Let's see. I think the, I can't do justice to, a long 500-page history of the place, but to summarize, the laboratory was started in 1952. And basically it was an interesting sort of arranged marriage between Ernest Lawrence and Edward Teller. And those were the two founding fathers. And they were started with basically 100 people, almost all of whom were part of Lawrence's existing laboratory that had nothing to do with nuclear weapons whatsoever. The initial cast of people knew almost nothing about nuclear weapons. There were no people from Los Alamos or anyplace else in 1952. And they started pretty much from scratch. And they had basically two instructions on their first day when they walked through the gates. And the first was, whatever you all do, do it different than what Los Alamos has done. Yeah. And that was the mantra for the first decade of the period, and that essentially set the tone. And the other thing, which was true, is they literally had no knowledge of how nuclear weapons worked. There are old stories about actually going to the high school with a security guard out front while Edward taught them what nuclear weapons were about from his experience. He was the only person, Edward Teller, who had been at the Los Alamos period during the Manhattan Project. No one else had been there. This was no knowledge. And in that period, using this guide of do it different than Los Alamos, they explored a wide range of different technologies, and eventually they came up with innovations in the particular way that nuclear weapons were designed. And combined with the existence of being able to use solid fuel rather than liquid fuel to send rockets up, the creation of Polaris, the first submarine launched ballistic missiles, Livermore's innovations in technology in the early 50s, after many failures, and that technology made it possible to do submarine launched ballistic missiles. And in 4 years, they basically, from 1956, when the inventions were made, through 1960, Polaris was launched, and that essentially made the Cold War cold. Mm-hmm. Before then, we'd had bomber fleets, we had a lot of tactical weapons, but all of those almost had to be in an active state. What submarine launched ballistic missiles did was basically, since you couldn't find submarines then and you can find submarines now, it always meant you had a response if you were ever attacked. And so when Livermore did the innovations to build Polaris, that created, made the Cold War cold. And at that moment, almost everything changed in the entire geopolitical framework of nuclear weapons. The second thing, after Polaris was created, Livermore used the same innovations it had done during those early years to, because they were so, they allowed you to make nuclear weapons much smaller and more effective per pound than they had ever been before. The Air Force got on board in the same way, and so Minuteman I, Minuteman II, and Minuteman III, which was the first MIRV system in the late 60s, essentially, by the end of the 60s, 1970, Livermore had the entire missile-based strategic stockpile as its design. And at the end of 1970, the two labs, Los Alamos and Livermore, essentially became comparable institutions. And over the last, 55 years, there have been ups and downs in the nuclear who was doing this or that. And there's been, and you can have a very, either we've been collaborative and competitors in basically fashioning the nuclear arsenal ever since. Livermore achieved more than parity in 1970, but then we gave some of that back and so on. And so that essentially is the story of how the nuclear weapons and the nuclear stockpile and the continuous evolution came to be. And so that, I think, is kind of the story. The other thing Livermore did that was different than Los Alamos, and I think had a big influence on national policy, and how this happened in a serendipitous way, is that the first five directors of Livermore all turned out to be two things. One, astonishingly good technical people, and people who eventually occupied extremely high positions in the Washington defense system. Herb York, the first director, became the first head of when DARPA was created. He was it. He was a confidant of Eisenhower's. The second director was Edward Teller, who was obviously a confidant of virtually everyone. The third was Harold Brown, who eventually became Carter's Secretary of Defense, and also was first head of Defense Research and Engineering. Johnny Foster, who is probably the most prominent of all of those in a funny way, was also the head of Defense Research and Engineering and just changed the entire defense structure for his nuclear understanding. And Mike May, the fifth of those directors, had an extraordinary career at the laboratory. When he stepped down as director, he essentially was the scientific leader of the lab for the next 15 to 20 years. He also, with Bill Perry, former Secretary of Defense, taught at Stanford for 20 years on the whole things of nuclear policy. So those five directors from 1952 through 1971, and if you want to just compare that to Norris Bradbury, who was Los Alamos director for 25 years, and Livermore had a free hand for those years with incredible senior talent, all of whom occupied senior positions in the nuclear defense world in Washington after that. And so that was a second contribution, which the system of somewhat led by Ernest Lawrence, because they all were Lawrence's guys. And so that was sort of an extraordinary thing. Just to jump back, and then I'll let Adam ask real questions. But I think the reason the book was titled The American Lab is because one of the things I did in writing my book was, and some had been done before I started to do it, was to take oral histories. And I probably did about 200 oral histories of the people who were there at the beginning and then later on. And those are all, you know, I'd interview and then we'd write them up afterwards. And the number of times the story would be someone, and I heard your interview with Tom, somebody who's went to a small Midwestern college and majored in engineering or science, would catch a Greyhound bus with $10 in his pocket, show up on Lawrence's door in Berkeley and say, "Can I get a job?" And what Livermore was founded from were people who did applied science, applied technology, and just came out to go to work without any pre-academic or other things. So we are an applied science, make things happen laboratory. And I think the contrast with Los Alamos, where there's a more of an academic sending, has always been there as one of the two differences between the labs. But it was those people who just came out here on their own from scratch and then became major contributors to the engineering and science. That's why it was called The American Lab, because that was kind of the American dream. Anyway, had to get a title. That was it.
Yeah. It's you know, it's interesting to hear what you've said so far and then compare it to what Tom and others have said. And it helps you to build this much sort of more complete picture of these earlier years of the labs. Now, the one question that, as you were talking about, you know, Livermore's successes is, you know, for me, you know, touring the NWIM out at the Weapons Museum out at Kirtland Air Force Base that DITRA has. And one of the things you always, you know, you look at them and you know, this is a Lannell design. This is a Livermore design. And, you know, as we talk through the designs, the Livermore designs are known for being more complicated. And so could you, or at least that's a reputation. Could you talk me through, you know, what was there a historical reason? Was it the competition between the labs? You know, what led to this, at least this reputation that Livermore always builds the more complicated designs?
This is, you know, there are lots of pieces to the answer, but if I had to pick the single thing that was very different during the first 20 years and then gradually after that, it sort of smoothed out a bit. But during the first 20 years, Livermore pursued the highest performance computing you could find on the planet at a much stronger level than did Los Alamos. And that was partly because Teller had personally done some research on, invented much of Monte Carlo techniques for doing all kinds of problems. But it's also because one of his best Hungarian colleagues growing up was Johnny von Neumann. And von Neumann was running the gigantic computer calculations back at Princeton to help both Livermore and Los Alamos. But Livermore pursued the super computers way before Los Alamos did in the 50s and 60s. And what it's almost going to get to an answer to your question. The people who in my meetings used to say, eventually he'll get there. And I think the short answer is, if you have a much, much more powerful computer system, and we wrote our own software, everything, the operating system, the whole thing back in the 50s and 60s, that it allowed you to do two-dimensional calculations effectively. And two dimensions allows you to actually calculate and understand and design in a in a much more complicated fashion than the fairly simple one-dimensional calculations, which was where Los Alamos happens. And again, after about the mid-70s, it all smoothed out. But eventually, Los Alamos went and got the Livermore codes in the late 60s. And because that's the one thing, that's the major difference apart from some of the people that happened during the 50s and 60s was our extreme emphasis on supercomputing in addition to all the other things we did in the experiments. So I think that's why the complicated designs.
That's a, you know, that's actually a really interesting answer to the question. That it's one I hadn't heard before. So that's a helpful thing. So the next time I'm going through the museum, I'll say, hey, let me explain to you why these designs are more complicated.
And of course, you may get a debate on that, kind of like you'll get a debate on anything. But this one I will state is it's all over the book. And it says it'll right. And again, once the 70s were there, then we've always both owned one of the two or three supercomputers in the world, and we still do. And so that's because that's always been at the very point of designing stuff.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the Amlaw Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
So speaking of supercomputers, I want to jump to the post-Cold War era.
Right.
Because it's supercomputing that allowed us, you know, that was played a critical role in stockpile stewardship. Can you talk to me about stockpile stewardship? Sort of, I mean, we kind of understand the motivation behind it. We, you know, there was a desire to no longer test. We thought that would, you know, no future testing would be safer. It would reduce political tensions. It would have these, you know, benefits. But talk to me about stockpile stewardship. We've had the Livermore director on. We've had the Los Alamos director on. We've talked about, hey, does it actually do what we need it to do to enable us to have reliable weapons? But tell me more. Tell me some of that history and some of, you know, that development and growth.
So, you know, I was there. I had just become director as basically we entered what became the stockpile stewardship era. And so a very, very brief background. When the Cold War ended, it took 2 or 3 years to quite absorb the impact of that throughout all the systems. But by the time we got, and under President George Bush the first, that was the last nuclear test in 1992. And when the new administration, the Clinton administration, came in, almost immediately, the weapons budgets went into free fall, literally free fall. We were diverting probably half of the funds that were nominally weapons funds into doing commercial partnerships. There were a number of commissions set up, and I won't go through all the details, it's old history now, to basically decide the future of all of the major federal science agencies, since defense was no longer going to be necessary at any serious level.
Sure.
And so things were basically just going through the floor. And the counter to that was really all because of one man, Vic Reese, who organized both constituencies, academic, laboratories, defense policy people, to ask all the relevant questions. And so the issue was what to do with a nuclear weapons world. And so, long story moderately short, you jump ahead, and there was a confidence conference held at the strategic in Omaha at Strategic Command in June of 1995. And we heard all the classified presentations on the impact of doing this or that or this. And then there were further conversations. And so the three WAB directors, myself, Sig Hager, and Paul Robinson, and then Vic Reese, Charlie Curtis, the Deputy Secretary of Energy, went back for two meetings. The first was with General Shelley Kashvili, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and the three WAB directors, myself, Paul, and Sig, met with Shelley for about 2 hours. And Shelley's one question was, so can you guys really do this job without testing? Because this was President Clinton's way of asking that question. And the interesting thing, Sig made this point many times, the interesting thing about the meeting, the only person in the room born in the United States was me.
Yeah.
Because Shalvey was Polish, Sig was born in Austria, Al Nareth was then the director of Sandia, was born in Germany, and I was born in Kentucky, which was probably counted as the United States at the time.
I think it counts.
But that was the conversation. It was an hour and a half like a PhD exam with Shelley. And we finished, and then we went over to the White House in the Situation Room with Tony Wake, who was the National Security Advisor, to have the same conversation. But the one with Shelley was the one that mattered. And that's the conversation along with the Omaha Strategic Command session and a lot of the take from Vic Reese, that which is when President Clinton said he would seek a comprehensive test ban treaty. The other thing that happened that was much more important, because there were a lot of provisions and we had classified conversations and all of that stuff that went into the actual proposal for the treaty, with all kinds of ways of backing out, a commitment for commitment for sufficient funds, a whole bunch of things like that. But there also was a proclamation issued by Clinton in September of 1995 that said, in order to pursue a CTBT, and I don't remember the exact wording, it is necessary to have the vitality of all three nuclear laboratories and sufficient funds to do the job. And so at that message from the beginning of 1995 through those two proclamations, that created the framework and the foundation for the stockpile stewardship program. Now, stockpile stewardship had three pieces. I mean, there's probably more you can add, but the three pieces were very simple. One, we have to have I'll do them in the reverse order that I usually do them. The first is we are going to have an annual certification statement each year for the first time in the history of the nuclear weapons program that tells the President of the United States whether the weapons are would need nuclear testing or whether they're capable and ready and safe and reliable as they are. And so that process is an official certification of the stockpile each year. I signed for the laboratory for the first 6 years of that process, as did the other lab directors and the head of Strategic Command. And every year, I haven't kept up with the details in the last several years, but every year we would pull from each of the different stockpile categories a weapon off the line, analyze it. Assume you were getting your annual physical. Okay,
right,
we gave each member of the stockpile an annual physical. If anything looked funny, we would then take and analyze it. Then we would do all the calculations and see if it mattered and so on. And so that process of giving it an annual physical and making the assessment and evaluation was a major process of going into stockpile stewardship, not just start and hope, but do this detailed stuff. That central piece of going into stockpile stewardship was to be sure to do that physical, to be able to handle the weapons in that context. Vic said we need two things. We need experimental facilities that probe all aspects in the laboratory that have relevance for understanding how well the weapons are working, And secondly, we need enormous computing. Because if it turns out, if you think about this for maybe just 30 seconds, the job we're going to do in stewardship is a very different job than we're going to do under design. When you design a weapon, it looks pretty. It's symmetric. It's nice and smooth. Think of a rocket. It's nice and smooth and symmetric. But you don't age in two dimensions or one dimension. You age in three dimensions. You can have a screwed up thing on one side of your heart and a lung over here. So you age in three dimensions just like a weapon does. If it has a crack or a rust or something else, it ages in three dimensions. And so the job you need to do to look at it after its annual physical is to look at it in three dimensions and then model it in three dimensions. A three-dimensional computer code is essentially 100,000 times bigger and more detailed than a two-dimensional code because it's got three dimensions. So, and 1,000, you usually use 1,000 points per each dimension. You need resolution because you're looking for imperfections, not for a smooth thing. And so right off the top, you knew you needed computers that were 100,000 times faster. And Vic Reese literally went to the new head of IBM and made that deal. And IBM, for the first time in many years, committed to providing the laboratories with every bit of effort IBM could bring forth. And one last thing, and then we'll jump to some other topic and get towards the end of the stewardship. But I knew it was important when Nick D'Onofrio, who was the head of R&D for IBM, and I went to the Livermore Airport to pick him up, and he was the only passenger on their 25-person plane, and I knew at that moment they actually cared a lot. Yeah, and so, sure. And Nick came out and lived with us for a week or two in that first time, just so that his guys and our guys created the new framework for computing, which is basically the foundation of what's happened ever since 1995 until today in computing. And at the moment this year, at Oak Ridge, at our lab, and these are multi-lab things, we will have exaflop computing, which is a billion times faster than the first IBM Livermore computer that was made. And wow. So that's the extraordinary thing in computing. The experimental facilities, Los Alamos has the DART, which is the hydrodynamic stuff of how do you look at primaries early on, not with the fuel, but look at the configurations. We have the National Ignition Facility, which explores all the high temperature stuff of a million degrees, hundreds of millions of degrees. And so all the experimental facilities that were part of stewardship have been also and very successful in understanding much more about the science of it than we ever had before. And so the answer we gave in 2000, when the CTBT finally came up for the vote, which didn't succeed, which was not a surprise, we followed the treaty without ratifying like we have with a lot of treaties. But all of us were asked the question in roughly 2000, can stewardship succeed? And our answer was, it's a very good bet, but it's not a sure thing. And I think it will always be true, but I think all the measures, and you've heard those from the people who've been responsible for the laboratories long after I've been gone, that in fact, it feels very successful. It's allowed us to learn. One of the fascinating things about a three-dimensional calculation, you can no longer look at numbers. And people actually looking at the pictures of these 3D calculations learned things about weapons they had never known before. Right. And so there's actually been real evidence of phenomena. And so I think, you hear this, you would need to have the current lab directors and their staffs who spend great effort in doing those annual certifications. But I think they have certainly validated all of the existing and current stockpile efforts as successful by any metric they can imagine.
Yeah. So unfortunately, we're at that time of the show where we're getting towards the end. But of course, I want to bring out Bob the Genie and rub my magic lamp. And Bob will grant you, Bruce, it's probably the first time in your life you've ever had a genie grant you three wishes. And so, of course, Bob grants them based on the topics we've discussed. And so with that in mind, Bruce, let me ask you, what is your first wish?
So, you know, this is the first wish is a fairly simple wish. It's hard to make it detail specific, but I must have served on 2 or 3 to 4 different commissions and stuff after I stopped being director, every one of which recommended that the bureaucracy and the Washington intrusion in the affairs of the lab be reduced by major factors.
Sure.
And so I would wish, as we have for each one of those commissions, my first wish would certainly be that I would wish we could dramatically reduce the enormous amount of they're probably impolite phrases that describe it.
Yeah. I mean, I thought all good things in the nation came out of Washington, but I guess I'm wrong. So, but yeah, okay. That's a good wish. That's a good wish. I think many people across the nation would have a similar wish. But okay. So wish number two.
Wish number two is a little, it's a variation on wish number one, but it's slightly different. It's the laboratories historically, particularly in the era where Tom's book talks about the first 10 years, and even the first, I arrived at the lab in 1967. And so I was fairly early, and I was there in 2 summers in 62 and 63. And in those days, you had a great freedom to try new things without going not just to Washington, but not even going much further than down the hall to explore new things. And I think all of that freedom is there under a more of a structured mechanism. I think the efforts to basically try new things and within limits to fail at least a third of the time,
right,
and not have that be a positive, not a negative, is something that I think is still important for the laboratories to have as an ideal, even if they don't get all the way there.
Absolutely. Failure is part of success. So that's a great one. Okay, so our final wish.
So this one you probably won't, given the nature of the organization, all you may find odd. But it seems to me that with, as I said, I would stay out of politics, but it seems to me that one of the worst aspects, I mean, there are many terrible aspects of the Putin stuff. It's hard to find anything that isn't just at the bottom of the barrel. But nonetheless, if I had to, I would actually wish we would find either a successor or again, a wish is a wish, would be able to reestablish arms control, talks, even negotiations with Russia and possibly even with China. And the rationale for that is not that I think the details of the arms control treaties ever mattered much. I mean, you can do angels on heads of pins, and they do that at just an incredible level. But the existence of those conversations, going through all of the arguments and the pros and cons of detectability, all the stuff that goes into arms control, at least means the sides are talking and communicating. And it seems to me one of the worst things about the current situation is that most of the ways of engaging, I mean, if people are talking to each other, they probably aren't actively fighting in a live fashion. And so I Sure. think having arms control, the framework to be an ongoing process, I think acts as a significant deterrence just because commitment to that is some measure that you both understand the character and nature of nuclear weapons and the potential for major accidents, mistakes, and disasters. And the last thing you ever want is for those things to result out of a screw-up by somebody as opposed to a conscious act. So that would be my third wish.
All right. Bruce Tarter, Director Emeritus of Lawrence Livermore National Lab, thanks for joining us on NucleCast.
Thank you.
And thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode, and we'll see you next time. Well, Bruce gave a great discussion of some of the early history and the why of how things happened, and it was really interesting. It filled in some gaps. I thought I knew quite a bit about the labs, and especially Livermore, because I've had an attachment with them for close to 20 years, but Bruce really gave some filled some gaps, some holes, had some aha moments. It was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. So I enjoyed the discussion. I hope you did as well.
This has been a production of the Amla Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krumpel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.